a list of 33 big investors to whom he should speak before making this decision. This client didn't know if Morgan had spoken to people beyond this list, but he confirmed for himself that Morgan had spoken to each of the 33 people individually. At the same time, Morgan and Levine began to ask some obvious questions about Goldman Sachs' stock market businesses. Could Goldman ever be as fast or as smart as the more nimble, high-frequency trading firms? Why, if Goldman only controlled 8% of all stock market orders, was it able to trade more than a third of those orders in its own dark pool? Given how little of the flow Goldman saw, what was the likelihood that the best price for an investor's order came from some other Goldman customer? How did Wall Street dark pools interact with each other and with the exchanges? How stable was this increasingly complex financial market? Was it a good thing that the U.S. stock market model had been exported to other countries and other financial markets? They already knew or could guess most of the answers. For the questions still hanging, the investors pointed them toward an unusually forthright and knowledgeable guy they knew and trusted who was starting a new stock exchange. Brad Katsuyama. What struck Brad about his visit to Goldman Sachs was not only that Levine and Morgan were willing to spend time with him, but that they took the ideas from their conversations to their superiors. Levine seemed particularly concerned about the stock market's instability. "Unless there are some changes, there's going to be a massive crash," he said. "A flash crash times 10. In conversation and in presentations, he impressed the point upon Goldman's top executives and also asked, "Do you really need the only differentiator in the market to be speed? Because that's what it seems to be." It wasn't all that hard for the people who ran Goldman Sachs to see the source of the problem or to see why no one inside the system cared to point it out. "There's no upside in it. That's why no one ever steps out on it," said Levine. "And everyone's got career risk, and no one is thinking that far ahead. They are looking at the next paycheck." A long string of myopic decisions had created new risks in the U.S. stock market. Its complexity was just one manifestation of the problem, but in it, the Goldman partners both felt sure lay some future calamity. The sensational technical glitches weren't anomalies, but symptoms. And a stock market calamity, Ron Morgan and Brian Levine both thought, would end up being blamed generally on the big Wall Street banks, and specifically on Goldman Sachs. Goldman earns $7 billion a year from its equity business. That business would be put at risk by any crisis. But it was more than that. At 48 and 43, respectively, Morgan and Levine were, by Wall Street standards, old guys. Morgan had been made a Goldman partner back in 2004, Levine in 2006. Both confided to friends that IEX presented them with a choice at what might be a pivotal financial historical moment. An investor who knew Ron Morgan said, "Ronnie's saying to himself, 'You work for 25 years in the business. How often do you have a chance to make a difference?'" Brian Levine himself said, "I think it's a business decision. I also think it's a moral decision. I think this is the shot we have. And I think Brad is the right guy. It's the best odds we have to fix the problem." Before they opened their market on October 25th, 2013, the 32 employees of IEX made private guesses as to how many shares they'd trade their first day and in their first week. The median of the estimates came in at 159,500 shares the first day and 2.5 million shares the first week. The lowest estimate came from Matt Trudeau, the only one of them who had ever built a new stock market from scratch. 2,500 shares for the first day and 100,000 for the week. Of the 94 stock brokerage firms in various stages of agreeing to connect to IEX, most of them small outfits, only about 15 were ready on the first day. "Brokers are telling their clients they're connected, but we haven't even gotten their paperwork," said Brad. When asked how big the exchange might be at the end of the first year, Brad guessed, or perhaps hoped, that it would trade between 40 and 50 million shares a day. To cover their running costs, they needed to trade about 50 million shares a day. If they failed to cover their running costs, there was a question of how long they could last. "It's binary," said Don Bullerman. "Either we are a resounding success, or we are a complete flop. We're done in 6 to 12 months. In 12 months, I know whether I need to look for a job." Brad thought that their bid to create an example of a fair financial market and maybe change Wall Street's culture could take longer and prove messier. He expected their first year to feel more like 19th century trench warfare than a 21st century drone strike. "We're just collecting data," he said. "You cannot make a case without data, and you don't have data unless you have trades." Even Brad agreed, "It's over when we run out of money." On the first day, they traded 568,524 shares. Most of the volume came from regional brokerage firms and Wall Street brokers that had no dark pools, the Royal Bank of Canada and Sanford Bernstein. Their first week, they traded a bit over 12 million shares. Each week after that, they grew slightly until in the third week of December, they were trading roughly 50 million shares each week. On Wednesday, December 18th, they traded 11,827,232 shares. By then, Goldman Sachs had connected to IEX, but its orders were arriving on the new exchange in the same untrusting spirit as those from the other big Wall Street banks, in tiny lot sizes, resting for just a few milliseconds, then leaving. The first different-looking stock market order sent by Goldman to IEX landed on December 19, 2013, at 3:09 p.m., 42 seconds, 662 milliseconds, 361 microseconds, and 406 nanoseconds. Anyone who had been in IEX's one-room office when it arrived would have known that something unusual was happening. The computer screens jitterbugged as the information flowed into the market in an entirely new way. One by one, the employees arose from their chairs. A few minutes into the surge, all but Zoran Perkoff were on their feet. Then they began to shout. "We're at 15 million," someone yelled, 10 minutes into the surge. In the previous 331 minutes, they had traded roughly 5 million shares. 20 million! Fucking Goldman Sachs! 30 million! The enthusiasm was unpracticed, almost unnatural. It was as if an oil well had gushed up through the floor during a meeting of the chess club. "We just passed Amex," shouted John Schwall, referring to the American Stock Exchange. "We're ahead of Amex in market share."
"And we gave them a 120-year head start," said Ronan, playing a little loose with history.
Someone had given Ronan a $300 bottle of champagne. He'd told Schwall that it had cost only $40 because Schwall didn't want anyone inside IEX accepting gifts of more than $40 from anyone outside of it. Now Ronan fished the contraband from under his desk and found some paper cups. Someone else put down a phone and said, "That was J.P. Morgan asking, 'What just happened?' They say they may have to do something." Don put down his phone.
That was Goldman. They say they aren't even big. They're coming big tomorrow.
40 million!
At his desk, Zoran sat calmly, watching traffic patterns. Don't tell anyone, but we're still bored, he said. This is nothing. 51 minutes after Goldman Sachs had given them their first honest shot at Wall Street customers' stock market orders, the U.S. stock market closed. Brad walked off the floor and into a small office enclosed by glass. He thought through what had just happened. We needed one person to buy in and say, "You're right," he said. "It means that Goldman Sachs agrees with us." Then he thought some more. Goldman Sachs wasn't a single entity. It was a bunch of people who didn't always agree with each other. Two of these people had been given a new authority, and they had used it to take a different, longer-term approach than anyone imagined Goldman Sachs was capable of. These two people made all the difference. "I got lucky. Brian is Brian, and Ronnie is Ronnie," said Brad. "This is because of them. Now the others can't ignore this. They can't marginalize it." Then he blinked. "I could fucking cry now," he said. He'd just been given a glimpse of the future. He felt certain of it. Goldman Sachs was insisting that the U.S. stock market needed to change, and that IEX was the place to change it. If Goldman Sachs was willing to acknowledge to investors that this new market was the best chance for fairness and stability, the other banks would be pressured to follow. The more orders that flowed into IEX, the better the experience for investors, and the harder it would be for the banks to evade this new, fair market. At that moment, as Goldman's orders flowed into IEX, the stock market felt a bit like a river that wanted to jump its banks. All that had been needed was for one man with a shovel to dig a trench in an existing levee, and the pressure from the water would finish the job, which was why men caught digging into the banks on certain stretches of the Mississippi River were once shot on sight. Brad Katsuyama was the man with the shovel, positioned at the river's most vulnerable bend. Goldman had arrived with explosives to help him. 3 weeks later, he stood before a group of investors who, if they acted together, might force change upon Wall Street. To show them that change was possible, he flashed on a big screen the data from what had happened for 51 minutes on December 19th. The data showed, among other things, the power of trust. Goldman had actually sent more orders to IEX the day before, on December 18th. So much more had traded on December 19th, because on that day, for just 51 minutes, Goldman had entrusted them with most of its orders for 10 seconds or more. That trust had been rewarded. The market felt fair. 92% of those orders traded at the midpoint, the fair price, compared to 17% that traded at the midpoint in Wall Street's dark pools. The number on the public exchanges was even lower. Their average trade size was twice the market average, despite the efforts of other Wall Street banks to undermine them. IEX represented a choice. IEX also made a point that this market, which had become intentionally and overly complicated, might be understood. That, to function properly, a free financial market didn't need to be rigged in someone's favor. It didn't need, in some sick way, the kickbacks and payment for order flow and co-location and all sorts of unfair advantages handed to a small handful of traders. All it needed was for the men in the room and the other investors like them to take responsibility for understanding it and then to seize its controls. "The backbone of the market is investors coming together to trade," said Brad. When he was finished, an investor raised his hand. "They did it on December 19th, he asked. And then what?
Chapter 8 The Spider and the Fly. The trial of Sergei Alenikov ran for 10 days in December of 2010 and was notable for its paucity of informed outsiders. High-frequency trading was a small world, and the people who did it or knew anything at all about it apparently had far less interest in testifying at trials than in making their personal fortunes. The one outside expert witness on the subject called by the government was an assistant professor of finance at Illinois Institute of Technology named Benjamin Van Vliet. Van Vliet had become an expert in response to journalists' need for one. While teaching a computer coding course, he'd cast around for something sexy for the students to program and landed on high-frequency trading platforms. In mid-2010, Forbes magazine called him out of the blue to ask him what he thought about a fiber-optic cable that Spread Networks had strung from Chicago to New Jersey. Van Vliet had never heard of Spread Networks and knew nothing about the cable, but wound up with his name in print, which of course led to more calls from journalists who needed a high-frequency trading expert. Then came the flash crash, and Van Vliet's phone rang off the hook. Eventually, federal prosecutors found him and asked him to serve as their expert witness in the trial of a former Goldman Sachs high-frequency programmer. Van Vliet still had never actually done any high-frequency trading himself, and had little to add on the value or the gist of what Serge Alenikov had taken from Goldman Sachs. About the market itself, he was badly misinformed. He described Goldman Sachs as the New York Yankees of high-frequency trading. He turned out to have testified as an expert witness in an earlier trial involving the theft of high-frequency trading code, after which the judge in the case said that the idea that a high-frequency trading program was some kind of science was utter baloney. The jury in Sergei Alenikov's trial consisted mainly of high school graduates. All of the jurors lacked experience programming computers. "They would bring my computer into the courtroom," recalled Serge incredulously. "They would pull out the hard drive and show it to the jury, as evidence." Save for Misha Malyshev, Serge's one-time employer, the people who took the stand had no credible knowledge of high-frequency trading, how the money got made, what sort of computer code was valuable, and so on. Malyshev testified, as a witness for the prosecution, that Goldman's code was of no use whatsoever in the system he had hired Serge to build. Goldman's code was written in a different programming language. It was slow and clunky. It had been designed for a firm that was trading with its own customers, and Teza, Malyshev's firm, didn't have customers and so on. But when he looked over, he saw that half the jury appeared to be sleeping. "If I were a juror and I wasn't a programmer," said Serge, "it would be very difficult for me to understand why I did what I did." Goldman Sachs' role in the trial was to make genuine understanding even more difficult. Its employees on the witness stand behaved more like salesmen for the prosecution than citizens of the state. "It's not that they lied," said Serge, "but they told things that were not in their expertise." When his former boss, Adam Schlesinger, was asked about the code, he said that everything at Goldman was proprietary. "I wouldn't say he lied, but he was talking about stuff that he did not understand, and so he was misunderstood," said Serge. Our system of justice is a poor tool for digging out a rich truth. What was really needed, it seemed to me, was for Serge Alenikov to be forced to explain what he had done and why to people able to understand the explanation and judge it. Goldman Sachs had never asked him to explain himself, and the FBI had not sought help from anyone who actually knew anything at all about computers or the high-frequency trading business. And so, over two nights, in a private room of a Wall Street restaurant, I convened a kind of second trial. To serve as both jury and prosecution, I invited a half dozen people intimately familiar with Goldman Sachs, high-frequency trading, and computer programming. All were authorities on our abstruse new stock market. Several had written high-frequency code. One had actually developed software for Goldman's high-frequency traders. All were men. They'd grown up in four different countries between them, but all now lived in the United States. All of them worked on Wall Street, and so to express themselves freely, they needed to remain anonymous. Among them were employees of IEX. All were naturally skeptical of both Goldman Sachs and Serge Alenikoff. They assumed that if Serge had been sentenced to 8 years in jail, he must have done something wrong. They just hadn't bothered to figure out what that was. All of them had followed the case in the newspapers and noted the shiver it had sent through the spines of Wall Street software developers. Until Serge was sent to jail for doing it, it was common practice for Wall Street programmers to take code they had worked on when they left for new jobs. A guy got put in jail for taking something no one understood, as one of Serge's new jurors put it. Every tech programmer out there got the message. Take code, and you could go to jail. It was huge. The arrest of Serge Alenikoff had also caused a lot of people, for the first time, to begin to use the phrase high-frequency trading. Another new juror, who in 2009 had worked for a big Wall Street bank, said, "When he was arrested, we had a meeting for all the electronic trading personnel to talk about a one-pager they'd drafted to be discussed with their clients around this new topic called high-frequency trading." The restaurant was one of those old-school Wall Street places that charge you $1,000 for a private room and then more or less challenge you to eat your way back to even. Food and drink arrived in massive quantities, vast platters of lobster and crab, steaks the size of desktop computer screens, smoking mountains of potatoes and spinach. It was the sort of meal cooked decades ago for traders who spent their days trusting their gut and their nights rewarding it. But this monstrous feast was now being served to a collection of weedy technologists, the people who controlled the machines that now controlled the markets, and who had, in the bargain, put the old school out of business. They sat around the table, staring at the piles of food, like a conquering army of eunuchs who had stumbled into the harem of their enemy. At any rate, they made hardly a dent. Serge, for his part, ate so little and with such disinterest that I half expected him to lift off his chair and float up to the ceiling. His new jurors began, interestingly, by asking him lots of personal questions. They wanted to figure out what kind of guy he was. They took an interest, for example, in his job market history and noted that his behavior was pretty consistently that of a geek who had more interest in his work than in the money the work generated. They established fairly quickly, how, I do not know, that he was not just smart, but seriously gifted. "These guys are usually smart in one small area," one of them later explained to me. "For a technologist to be so totally dominant in so many areas is just really, really unusual." They then began to probe his career at Goldman Sachs. They were surprised to learn that he had super user status inside Goldman, which is to say he was one of a handful of people, roughly 35 in a firm that then had more than 31,000 employees, who could log onto the system as an administrator. Such privileged access would have enabled him, at any time, to buy a cheap USB flash drive, plug it into his terminal, and take all of Goldman's computer code without anyone having any idea that he had done it. That fact alone didn't prove anything to them. As one pointed out to Serge directly, lots of thieves are sloppy and careless. Just because he was sloppy and careless didn't mean he was not a thief. On the other hand, they all agreed there wasn't anything the least bit suspicious, much less nefarious, about the manner in which he had taken what he had taken. Using a subversion repository to store code and deleting one's bash history were common practices. The latter made a great deal of sense if you typed your passwords into command lines. In short, Serge had not behaved like a man trying to cover his tracks. One of his new jurors stated the obvious. If deleting the bash history was so clever and devious, why had Goldman ever found out he'd taken anything? To these new jurors, the story that the FBI found so unconvincing that Serge had taken the files because he thought he might later like to parse the open source code contained within made a lot of sense. As Goldman hadn't permitted him to release his debugged or improved code back to the public, even though the original free license often stated that improvements must be publicly shared, the only way for him to get his hands on these files was to take the Goldman code. That he had also taken some code that wasn't open source, which happened to be in the same files as the open source code, surprised no one. Grabbing a bunch of files that contained both open source and non-open source code was an efficient way for him to collect the open source code, even if the open source code was the only code that interested him. It would have made far less sense for him to hunt around the internet for the open source code he wanted, as it was scattered all over cyberspace. It was also entirely plausible to them that Serge's interest was confined to the open source code, because that was the general purpose code that might be repurposed later. The Goldman proprietary code was written specifically for Goldman's platform. It would have been of little use in any new system he wished to build. The two small pieces of code Serge had sent into Tezza's computers before his arrest both came with open-source licenses. Even if he had taken Goldman's whole platform, it would have been faster and better for him to write the new platform himself, said one juror. Several times Serge surprised the jurors with his answers. They were all shocked, for instance, that from the day Serge first arrived at Goldman, he had been able to send Goldman's source code to himself weekly, without anyone at Goldman saying a word to him about it. At Citadel, if you stick a USB drive into your workstation, someone is standing next to you within 5 minutes asking you what the hell you are doing, said a juror who had worked there. Most were surprised by how little Serge had taken in relation to the whole, 8 megabytes, in a platform that consisted of nearly 1,500 megabytes of code. The most cynical among them were surprised mostly by what he had not taken. "Did you take the strats?" asked one, referring to Goldman's high-frequency trading strategies. "No," said Serge. That was one thing the prosecutors hadn't accused him of. "But that's the secret sauce, if there is one," said the juror. "If you're going to take something, take the strats." "I wasn't interested in the strats," said Serge. "But that's like stealing the jewelry box without the jewels," said another juror. "You had super user status," said the first. "You could easily have taken the strats. Why didn't you?" "To me, the technology really is more interesting than the strats," said Serge. "You weren't interested in how they made hundreds of millions of dollars?" asked someone else. "Not really," said Serge. "It's all one big gamble one way or another." Because they had seen it before in other programmer types, They were not totally shocked by his indifference to Goldman's trading, or by how far Goldman had kept him from the action. Talking to a programmer type about the trading business was a bit like talking to the house plumber at work in the basement about the card game the Mafia Don was running upstairs. He knew so little about the business context, one of the jurors said, after attending both dinners. You'd have to try to know as little as he did. Another said, he knew as much as they wanted him to know about how they made money, which was virtually nothing. He wasn't there for very long. He came in with no context, and he spent all of his time troubleshooting. Another said he had found Serge to be the epitome of the programmer whose value the big Wall Street banks tried to minimize by using their skills without fully admitting them into the business. You see two resumes from the banks, he said. You line them up on paper and say maybe there's a 10% difference between them. But one guy is getting paid 300 grand, and the other is getting 1.5 million. The difference is one guy has been given the big picture, and the other hasn't. Serge had never been shown the big picture. Still, it was obvious to the jurors, even if it wasn't to Serge, why Goldman had hired him when it had. With the introduction of Reg NMS in 2007, the speed of any financial intermediary's trading system became its most important attribute. The speed with which it took in market data, and the speed with which it responded to that data. Whether he knew it or not, said one juror, he was hired to build Goldman's view of the market. No Reg NMS, no surge in finance. At least some part of the reason he remained oblivious to the nature of Goldman Sachs' trading business, all of the jurors noticed, was that his heart was elsewhere. I think passion plays a big role, said a juror who himself had spent his entire career writing code. The moment he started talking about coding, his eyes lit up. Another added, the fact that he kept trying to work on open source shit, even while he was at Goldman, says something about the guy. They didn't all agree that what Serge had taken had no value, either to him or to Goldman. But what value it might have had in creating a new system would have been trivial and indirect. I can guarantee you this. He did not steal code to use it on some other system, one said, and none of the others disagreed. For my part, I didn't fully understand why some parts of Goldman's system might not be useful in some other system. Goldman's code base is like buying a really old house, one of the jurors explained, and you take the trouble to soup it up, but it still has the problems of a really old house. Tezza was going to build a new house on new land. Why would you take 100-year-old copper pipes and put them in my new house? It isn't that they couldn't be used. It's that the amount of trouble involved in making it useful is ridiculous. A third added, it's way easier to start from scratch. Their conviction that Goldman's code was not terribly useful outside of Goldman grew even stronger when they learned, later, as Serge failed to mention it at the dinners, that the new system Serge planned to create was to be written in a different computer language than the Goldman code. The perplexing question, at least to me, was why Serge had taken anything. A full month after he'd left Goldman Sachs, he still had not touched the code he had taken. If the code was so unimportant to him that he didn't bother to open it up and study it, if most of it was either so clunky or so peculiar to Goldman's system that it was next to useless outside Goldman, why take it? Oddly, his jurors didn't find this hard to understand. One put it this way. If person A steals a bike from person B, then person A is riding a bike to school, and person B is walking. Person A is better off at the expense of person B. That is clear cut, and most people's view of theft. In Serge's case, think of being at a company for 3 years, and you carry a spiral notebook and write everything down. Everything about your meetings, your ideas, products, sales, client meetings, it's all written down in that notebook. You leave for your new job and take the notebook with you, as most people do. The contents of your notebook relate to your history at the prior company, but have very little relevance to your new job. You may never look at it again. Maybe there are some ideas or templates or thoughts you can draw on, but that notebook is related to your prior job, and you will start a new notebook at your new job, which will make the old one irrelevant. For programmers, their code is their spiral notebook. It enables them to remember what they worked on, but it has very little relevance to what they will build next. He took a spiral notebook that had very little relevance outside of Goldman Sachs. To the well-informed jury, the real mystery wasn't why Serge had done what he had done. It was why Goldman Sachs had done what it had done. Why on earth call the FBI? Why exploit the ignorance of both the general public and the legal system about complex financial matters to punish this one little guy? Why must the spider always eat the fly? The financial insiders had many theories about this, that it was an accident, that Goldman had called the FBI in haste and then realized the truth, but lost control of the legal process, that in 2009 Goldman had been on hair trigger alert to personnel losses in high frequency trading, because they could see how much money would be made from it and thought they could compete in the business. The jurors all had ideas about why what had happened had happened. One of the theories was more intriguing than the others. It had to do with the nature of a big Wall Street bank and the way people who worked at it, at the intersection of technology and trading, got ahead. As one juror put it, "Every manager of a Wall Street tech group likes to have people believe that his guys are geniuses. Russians, whatever. His whole persona among his peers is that what he and his team do can't be replicated. When people find out that 95% of their code is open source, it kills that perception. What the guy can't say when he gets told Serge has taken something is, it doesn't matter what he took because it's worse than what they'll create on their own." So when the security people come to him and tell him about the downloads, he can't say, "No big deal." And he can't say, "I don't know what he took." To put it another way, the process that ended with Serge Alenikov sitting inside two holding facilities that house dangerous offenders and then a federal prison may have started with the concern of some Goldman Sachs manager with his bonus. "Who is going to pull the fire alarm before they smell the fire?" asked the juror who had advanced this last theory. "It's always the people who are politically motivated." As he left dinner with Serge Alenikov and walked down Wall Street, he thought about it some more. "I'm actually nauseous," he said. "It makes me sick." The mystery the jury of Sergei Alenikov's peers had more trouble solving was Serge himself. He appeared, and perhaps even was, completely at peace with the world. Had you lined up the people at those two Wall Street dinners and asked the American public to vote for the man who had just lost his marriage, his home, his job, his life savings, and his reputation, Serge would have come dead last. At one point, one of the people at the table stopped the conversation about computer code and asked, "Why aren't you angry?" Serge just smiled back at him. "No, really," said the juror. "How do you stay so calm? I'd be fucking going crazy." Serge smiled again. "But what does craziness give you?" he said. What does negative demeanor give you as a person? It doesn't give you anything. You know that something happened. Your life happened to go in that particular route. If you know that you're innocent, know it. But at the same time, you know you are in trouble, and this is how it's going to be. To which he added, "To some extent, I'm glad this happened to me. I think it strengthened my understanding of what living is all about." At the end of his trial, when the original jury returned with its guilty verdict, Serge had turned to his lawyer, Kevin Marino, and said, "You know, it did not turn out the way we had hoped, but I have to say, it was a pretty good experience." It was as if he were standing outside himself and taking in the situation as an observer. "I've never seen anything like it," said Marino. In the comfort of the Wall Street cornucopia, that notion that the hellish experience he'd been through had actually been good for him was too weird to pursue, and the jurors had quickly returned to discussing computer code and high-frequency trading. But Serge actually believed what he had said. Before his arrest, before he lost much of what he thought important in his life, he went through his days and nights in a certain state of mind, a bit self-absorbed, prone to anxiety and worry about his status in the world. "When I was arrested, I couldn't sleep," he said. "When I saw articles in the newspaper, I would tremble at the fear of losing my reputation. Now, I just smile. I no longer panic, or have panic ideas that something could go wrong." By the time he was first sent to jail, his wife had left him, taking their three young daughters with her. He had no money, and no one to turn to. He didn't have very close friends, his fellow Russian emigre Masha later recalled. "He never did. He's not a people person. He didn't even have anyone to be power of attorney." Out of a sense of Russian solidarity and out of pity, she took the job, which meant, among other things, frequent trips to visit Serge in prison. "Every time I would come to visit him in jail, I would leave energized by him," she said. "He radiated so much energy and positive emotions that it was like therapy for me to visit him. His eyes opened to how the world really is. And he started talking to people for the first time. He would say, 'People in jail have the best stories.' He could have considered himself a tragedy, and he didn't." By far the most difficult part of his experience was explaining what had happened to his children. When he was arrested, his daughters were 5, 3, and almost 1. "I tried to put it in the most simple terms they would understand," said Serge, "but the bottom line was, I was apologizing for the fact that this had happened." In jail, he was allowed 300 minutes a month on the phone, and for a long time the kids, when he called them, didn't pick up on the other end. The holding facility in which Serge spent his first 4 months was violent and essentially nonverbal, but he didn't find it hard to stay out of trouble there. He even found people he could talk to and enjoy talking to. When they moved him to the minimum security prison at Fort Dix in New Jersey, he was still in a room crammed with hundreds of other roommates, but he now had space to work. He remained in some physical distress, mainly because he refused to eat meat. His body, he had really bad times there, said Masha later. He lived on beans and rice. He was always hungry. I'd buy him these yogurts, and he would gulp them down one after another. His mind still worked fine, though, and a lifetime of programming in cube farms had left him with the ability to focus in prison conditions. A few months into Serge's jail term, Masha later received a thick envelope from him. It contained roughly 100 pages covered on both sides in Serge's meticulous 8-point script. It was computer code, a solution to some high-frequency trading problem. Serge feared that if the prison guards found it, they wouldn't understand it, decide that it was suspicious, and confiscate it. A year after he'd been sent away, the appeal of Serge Alenikov was finally heard by the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. The judgment was swift, unlike anything his lawyer, Kevin Marino, had seen in his career. Marino was by then working gratis for a client who was dead broke. The very day he made his argument, the judges ordered Serge released, on the grounds that the laws he stood accused of breaking did not actually apply to his case. At 6 in the morning on February 17, 2012, Serge received an email from Kevin Marino saying that he was to be freed. A few months later, Marino noticed that the government had failed to return Serge's passport. Marino called and asked for it back. The passport never arrived. Instead, Serge, now staying with friends in New Jersey, was arrested again and taken to jail. Once again, he had no idea what he was being arrested for, but this time neither did the police. The New Jersey cops who picked him up didn't know the charges, only that he should be held without bail, as he was deemed a flight risk. His lawyer was just as perplexed. "When I got the call," said Marino, "I thought it might have something to do with Serge's child support." It didn't. A few days later, Manhattan District Attorney Cyrus Vance sent out a press release to announce that the state of New York was charging Serge Alenikov with accessing and duplicating a complex proprietary and highly confidential computer source code owned by Goldman Sachs. The press release went on to say that this code is so highly confidential that it is known in the industry as the firm's secret sauce, and thanked Goldman Sachs for its cooperation. The prosecutor assigned to the case, Joanne Lee, claimed that Serge was a flight risk and needed to be re-jailed immediately, which was strange because Serge had gone to and returned from Russia between the time of his first arrest and his first jailing. It was Lee who soon fled the case to a job at Citigroup. Marino recognized the phrase secret sauce. It didn't come from the industry, but from his opening statement in Serge's first trial, when he mocked the prosecutors for treating Goldman's code as if it were some secret sauce. Otherwise, Serge's rearrest made no sense to him. To avoid double jeopardy, the Manhattan DA's office had found new crimes with which to charge Serge for the same actions. But the sentencing guidelines for the new crimes meant that even if he was convicted, it was very likely he wouldn't have to return to jail. He'd already served time for crimes the court ultimately determined he had not committed. Marino called Vance's office. They told me that they didn't need him to be punished anymore, but they need him to be held accountable, said Marino. They want him to plead guilty and let him go on time served. I told them in the politest terms possible that they can go fuck themselves. They ruined his life. Oddly enough, they hadn't. Inside of me, I was completely witnessing, said Serge, about the night of his rearrest. There was no fear, no panic, no negativity. His children had reattached themselves to him, and he had a new world of people to whom he felt close. He thought he was living his life as well as it had ever been lived. He'd even started a memoir to explain what had happened to anyone who might be interested. He began, "If the incarceration experience doesn't break your spirit, it changes you in a way that you lose many fears. you begin to realize that your life is not ruled by your ego and ambition, and that it can end any day at any time. So, why worry? You learn that just like on the street, there is life in prison, and random people get there based on the jeopardy of the system. The prisons are filled by people who cross the law, as well as by those who were incidentally and circumstantially picked and crushed by somebody else's agenda. On the other hand, as a vivid benefit, you become very much independent of material property and learn to appreciate very simple pleasures in life, such as the sunlight and morning breeze. Epilogue. Riding the Wall Street Trail. For at least a few members of the Women's Adventure Club of Center County, Pennsylvania, the weather was never much of an issue. The Women's Adventure Club had been created by Lisa Wandell, an administrator at Penn State University, after she realized that many women were afraid to hike alone in the woods. The club now had more than 700 members, and its sense of adventure had expanded far beyond a walk in the woods. Between them, the four women who met me on their bicycles beside the Pennsylvania road had learned the flying trapeze, swum the Chesapeake Bay, and won silver at the Downhill Mountain Biking World Championships. They had finished a road bike race called the Gran Fondo, Masochistic Metric, a foot race called the Tough Mudder, and three separate 24-hour-long mountain bike races. They had graduated from race car driving school and made 13 polar bear plunges in some local river in the dead of winter. After studying the Women's Adventure Club's website, Ronan had said, "It's a bunch of lunatic women who meet up and do dangerous shit. I gotta get my wife into it." In the bleak January light, we pedaled onto Route 45 out of Bowlesburg, Pennsylvania, heading east, along what was once the route for the stagecoach that ran from Philadelphia to Erie. It was 9 in the morning and still below freezing, with a stiff breeze lowering the wind chill to 11 degrees. The views were of farms and fallow brown fields, and the road was empty except for the occasional pickup truck roaring past us with real anger. "They hate bikers," explained one of the women adventurers mildly. "They try to see how close they can get." The women rode this stretch of road every so often, and had noticed when the fiber optic line was being laid beside it back in 2010. From time to time, one of the road's two lanes was closed by the line's construction crews. You'd see these motley queues of bikes, cars, pickup trucks, Amish horse-drawn carts, and farm equipment waiting for the tail end of the oncoming traffic. The crews trenched the ground between the paved road and the farms, making it difficult for the Amish in their wagons to get back to their homes. Sometimes you'd see these Amish kids, the girls in their pretty purple dresses, hopping off the wagon and leaping over the trench. The members of the Women's Adventure Club had been told by a local government official that the fiber optic line was a government project to provide high-speed internet access to local colleges. Hearing that it was actually a private project to provide a 3-millisecond edge to high-frequency traders, they had some new questions about it. "How does a private line get access to a public right-of-way?" asked one. "I'm really curious to know that." We're in a transition here. That's what the Goldman Sachs people said when you asked them, in so many words, how they could have gone from bringing the wrath of U.S. prosecutors down upon Serge Alenikov for emailing their high-frequency trading computer code to himself, to helping Brad Katsuyama change the U.S. stock market in ways that would render Goldman's high-frequency trading computer code worthless. There was a connection between Serge Alenikoff and Goldman's behavior on December 19, 2013. The trial and the publicity that attended it caused a lot of people to think more rigorously about the value of Goldman Sachs' high-frequency trading code. High-frequency trading had a winner-take-all aspect. The fastest predator took home the fattest prey. By 2013, the people charged with determining Goldman's stock market strategy had concluded that Goldman wasn't very good at this new game, and that Goldman was unlikely ever to be very good at it. The high-frequency traders would always be faster than Goldman Sachs or any other big Wall Street bank. The people who ran Goldman Sachs's stock market department had come to understand that what Serge had taken wasn't worth stealing, at least not by anyone whose chief need was speed. The trouble for any big Wall Street bank wasn't simply that a big bureaucracy was ill-suited to keeping pace with rapid technological change, but that the usual competitive advantages of a big Wall Street bank were of little use in high-frequency trading. A big Wall Street bank's biggest advantage was its access to vast amounts of cheap risk capital, and with that, its ability to survive the ups and downs of a risky business. That meant little when the business wasn't risky and didn't require much capital. High-frequency traders went home every night with no position in the stock market. They traded in the market the way card counters in a casino played blackjack. They played only when they had an edge. That's why they were able to trade for 5 years without losing money on a single day. A big Wall Street bank really had only one advantage in an ever-faster financial market: first shot at its own customers' stock market trades. So long as the customers remained inside the dark pool and in the dark, the bank might profit at their expense. But even here, the bank would never do the job as efficiently or thoroughly as a really good HFT. It was hard to resist the pressure to hand the prey over to the more skilled predator, to ensure that the kill was done quickly and discreetly, and then, after the kill, to join in the feast as a kind of junior partner, though more junior than partner. In the dark pool arbitrage IEX had witnessed, for instance, HFT captured about 85% of the gains, leaving the bank with just 15%. The new structure of the U.S. stock market had removed the big Wall Street banks from their historic, lucrative role as intermediary. At the same time, it created, for any big bank, some unpleasant risks: that the customer would somehow figure out what was happening to his stock market orders, and that the technology might somehow go wrong. If the markets collapsed, or if another flash crash occurred, the high-frequency traders would not take 85% of the blame or bear 85% of the costs of the inevitable lawsuits. The banks would bear the lion's share of the blame and the costs. The relationship of the big Wall Street banks to the high-frequency traders, when you thought about it, was a bit like the relationship of the entire society to the big Wall Street banks. When things went well, the HFT guys took most of the gains. When things went badly, the HFT guys vanished, and the banks took the losses. Goldman had figured all of this out, probably before the other big Wall Street banks, to judge from its treatment of IEX. By December 19, 2013, the people newly installed on top of Goldman Sachs's stock market operations, Ron Morgan and Brian Levine, wanted to change the way the market worked. They were obviously sincere. They truly believed that the market at the heart of the world's largest economy had grown too complex and was likely to experience some catastrophic failure. But they also were trying to put an end to a game they could never win or control. And so they'd flipped a switch and sent lots of their customers' stock market orders to IEX.